This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, Danny Glover joins the American Postal Workers Union.
We turn our attention now to the battle to save the post office and good union jobs. Protests have escalated into a national boycott now in the struggle to save the post office of Staples for its proposed deal with the post office to privatize retail postal services. Internal UPS documents reveal that the Staples deal is an attempt to reduce the cost of traditional postal union labor and shift it to low-wage labor.
While the post office tries to save money by degrading their workers' remuneration, it ignores a proposal by its own inspector general, Postal Banking. President Dimenstein said basic nonprofit banking would be a great and real benefit to the people of this country and a good answer to what I call the Wall Street banksters, who devastated the economy and with it the lives of millions of people.
And we speak now with President of the American Postal Workers Union, Mark Dimenstein, and it's good to have you with us on Building Bridges.
Well, let me first say thanks for having me on.
Then maybe we can begin by just laying out the concept of postal banking.
The concept of postal banking is actually nothing new. It was done in this country for about 50, 55 years up until the mid-1960s. It's done throughout most of Europe, and the basic concept is that in the trusted environment of the Postal Service, and more or less on a nonprofit basis, there can be basic banking services. I think probably most of your listeners have bought a money order in their lives and paid bills that way, or cash money orders. That's a vestige of the postal banking system. So we think it would be a great service to the people of this country, and it would strengthen the Postal Service at the same time. We're for expanded enhanced services to the people. And it's a great social need that needs to be met out there.
If I may, how does that differ from the post office as we now know it?
Well, the post office as we now know it does not offer an array of financial services to the people. So you have, as I was saying, there's a great social need. You have, according to the Office of the Inspector General of the United States Postal Service, so this isn't Mark Dimenstein speaking, which did a study on this issue. There's about 68 million adults in this country who are unbanked. About 38% of the zip codes in this country have no bank. Another 21% have only one bank. And their study included the problems when people are forced into what I call the legal loan sharking side of the house. This is not what the OIG called it, but it's predatory lending. And they talked about how many thousands of dollars a year low-wage workers, the working poor, have to spend when they're stuck outside of the banking system. So the post office does not provide those services now, only a vestige of that service with money orders. So the difference would be that when people visit their neighborhood post office or their small-town post office, that they could actually do basic banking, whether it be some checking, some savings, money transfers, and so on and so forth, small loans. And so that would be a difference. It would be much more like many countries in the Europe where people can go take care of their postal business and they can take care of their checking account.
The Inspector General laid out a fairly limited role for postal banking. Do you think there might be a bigger role, and would this require congressional authorization?
I think that there's definitely a space and an important role for a deeper role than what the OIG laid out. But our union is prepared to back the OIG's plan as a big step forward. And one of the beautiful things of that recommendation that they made was that, number one, there does not have to be, in their view, any legislative action. That the post office has within their authority now to do the array of financial services that they talked about. I would like to see a true public option, what we call the greedy, too-big-to-fail banking system we have now. But short of that, I think it would be a great step forward to have the kind of financial services that the OIG talked about. And I think that would be a step towards, a big step towards, that public option that the people of this country should have and we all need. So it's I'd rather take it one big step forward and then build on it from there. The banks obviously have a lot of influence and they're lobbyists in Congress. If we can force the Postmaster General and the Post Office to provide this service without legislative action, I think that's a better way to go.
And let's turn our attention for a moment to Staples. Tell us about the proposal that has caused the escalation nationwide of a boycott of Staples. What's going on there with the efforts to essentially privatize the retail postal services?
Yeah, it's more of an idea. They actually, the post office and Staples reach what we call a dirty deal in what they call a pilot program, a test program.
That's already underway?
It's already underway. Mm-hmm. It opened about late October 2013. It's about in 82 Staples stores with the goal of the post office and Staples spreading it throughout the entire Staples chain. And the post office has a five-year plan where they would like to do this with other major retail chains. So we have three basic problems with this. One is that we think, well, if I can back up a minute, we are for expanded services to the people of this country, but we think that should primarily take place within the existing postal service, where post office can be open later, they can be open on weekends, they can provide more service, such as the postal banking issues we were just talking about. But so what happened with Staples is three major problems. One is that when the public goes and gets, quote, postal services at these what we call knockoff post offices, they're not really at a post office. They're not being serviced by trained, accountable postal workers. And that's not to criticize Staples workers at all. We want Staples workers to do well. But Staples in the post office is not training the employees in those stores, and it's not considered mail when it's in those stores. So the very sanctity and the security and the privacy of the mail is not there in a Staples store. Two is it's definitely a shift of decent union wage jobs, living wage jobs, to low wage, non-benefited, non-union jobs. And that's something that we think is not only bad for postal workers, we think it's bad for our communities. You know, the politicians prattle about income inequality. This is the way you create income inequality. Transfer living wage jobs to low wage jobs. And thirdly is the whole privatization piece of this. So the question of whether people will get mail services, under what conditions, and if they even get them, will be based on whether a company like Staples can make a bottom dollar. So here Staples has already announced that they're closing 225 stores. So imagine if Staples becomes the post office, just as if, let's say, Blockbuster or Circuit City had become the post office. Now, in 1989, the post office tried this with Sears. Sears is about gone. So if we don't have postal services where it's universal, guaranteed, in the public domain, then the question of whether people get services at all will depend on the bottom dollar, not on the public good.
Now, there were national protests, I believe it was on April 24th or 24th, okay.
24th, right.
Well, tell us about that, and also if you talk about the boycott.
Okay. So on the 24th, and it didn't start with the 24th, it didn't end with the 24th, but the 24th was a culmination of a lot of activity, going to Staples stores, sending delegations of protest. This all started with us simply asking Staples to sit down with us and seeing if we could work this out. And the post office, we asked for the same thing. And we initially simply said, staff those pilots within Staples with postal employees, and we'll go along with the program, look at it after a year, and look at the pros and cons. Staples said no. The post office said no. So we started with delegations. We had ongoing protests in the areas where these pilot stores have actually opened, and then we built to the national day. And that was at Staples all over the country. We had, I think, 56 or 57 protests in about 27 states. Since then, we initially said, look, put postal workers in there accountable to the people of the country. And if not, we're going to take our business elsewhere and encourage our friends, family, co-workers, and allies to do the same. After the 24th, we simply said, since you have not put postal workers in the stores, we're asking people to take their business elsewhere. So right after the 24th, the California teachers voted to boycott, the New Hampshire teachers voted to boycott, the Michigan teachers voted to boycott. The SEIU now, which is, I think, the largest union in the country, has joined the boycott. The AFL-CIO, 12 million members strong, has endorsed the boycott. Staples is not a model of a good employee here. They've had to pay $42 million in wage theft, in back pay. They're one of these companies that's turning people into part-time workers to avoid any obligation under the Affordable Care Act to their staple employees working in the stores. So they're the opposite of a good model employer, and obviously Staples employees need to fix those matters and take some of those issues into their own hands as well. But anyway, the teachers are very important. They're the largest single group of customers of Staples because of the back-to-school issues, the influence with the parents of the students that are buying back-to-school products. The American Federation of Teachers, we expect, will openly join the boycott shortly, and we're sending the message to Staples that privatization is not the way to go. You want to do office supplies, we got no problem. You want to do postal public services, we got a serious problem.
And take us back full to the beginning of the evolution of the, really, the contempt and the effort to decimate the postal service as we know it, and the contradictions that were there about the issues of funding the postal service and so on, because I think we still need to explode much of that.
Okay, it depends how far back you want to go, but let's at least go back to 2006.
The Pony Express. No,
Well, it shows how important the post office has been in the history of this country, and it shows the potential in the future as well. But at least going back to 2006, that's when the Postal Accountability Enhancement Act was passed. This was passed with bipartisan support in Congress. And what it did, in essence, that set this new push of privatization forward and undermining the entire service as a path to more privatization, was it manufactured a financial crisis. And it did that by putting a financial burden on the post office to pre-fund retiree health insurance, not ongoing health insurance, retiree health insurance, 75 years into the future, and to do it within 10 years. So for a worker not even born yet, the post office is obligated to pre-fund that amount into the federal treasury. So what it represented was just an absurd and unfair burden that no other agency and no other company faces. And the post office can't pay it. It's $5.5 billion a year. They cannot pay it, and then the pundits are out there every time you open a newspaper, every time somebody in Congress who wants to privatize everything stands up. They lost another $5 billion last year, and that's what's being used to create this climate that they have to close more plants, that they have to go to five-day mail delivery, that they have to privatize and be competitive and get lower wages and so on and so forth. So that's an easy fix. If Congress wanted to do it, the PAEA represents a looting of the public till, not in the tax dollar till, because no tax money goes to the Postal Service. It's the revenue is created by the user, but it's public money in that sense. It's a public entity, and it represents a raiding of those funds, shifting it over, and then saying, "Hey, post office is broke. Well, guess what? The operating expenses last year were $600 million to the good, and this year it's $1.3 billion to the good. That's if you take out this $5.5 billion a year pre-funding manufactured crisis. So,
well, I think we get the idea, and unfortunately we're going to have to leave it there, but you've certainly given us a panoramic view of what happened and what needs to be done, and we're right on board with boycotting Staples. We can't privatize our post office.
Thank you. This is a great national treasure, and as we're saying, the U.S. mail is not for sale, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
Indeed, the U.S.
Take
mail
care.
Is not for sale. We're going to make sure of that. Mark Dimmelstein is the president of the American Postal Workers Union, and it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Take care.
Danny Glover has always championed civil and labor rights. And at the American Postal Workers Union convention recently, he literally returned to his roots to support the post office and postal workers.
The brother standing next to me, who flew from Europe this morning to be with us and to be a face of saving the national treasure called the United States Postal Service, is going to speak to this convention today, brothers and sisters. And he had a birthday this week, and we're going to sing to him, happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. A terrific social activist, a well-known actor, producer, conscience of the people of this country out there with the Nissan workers trying to organize into the UAW in Mississippi, a product of postal worker parents who believes deep in his heart as we do that a government of, by, and for the people is really a government of, by, and for the working people primarily. Sisters and brothers, it is a tremendous honor to introduce to you, on behalf of all of you, on behalf of the executive board, brother Danny Glover.
My brothers and sisters from the APWU, let me tell you how proud I am to be here. I was born 68 years ago in San Francisco, California. My parents became postal workers in 1948. Let me give some kind of context to this. The U.S. Armed Forces were desegregated in 1947. The federal workplace was desegregated in 1948. My parents came to the post office. My father, who had served in the military during World War II, my mother, who had graduated from a small college in rural Georgia and had found their way to San Francisco and became postal employees. What I understood in the midst of a civil rights movement that my mother and father, as a young child, were engaged in change. Not only had the demographics of the post office changed, bringing substance and bringing position and bringing jobs to African Americans for the first time in the public space. Not only had that changed, but there was in the midst of a great movement in this country as well. And really, if we look at labor, and the expansion of the public service sector, the expansion of public workers, is right after World War II. So they came at the hest of this moment, this great moment in this country's history, providing and building a middle class, expanding infrastructure, building schools, building housing, building small business. All this was happening at this particular point in time. I was born into that. And because my parents lend their voice from the outset, my life was guided by their passion, guided by that wisdom, guided by their involvement, engagement. My life became guided by that. So this union of postal workers, I worked at the post office during those moments when you were able to work a week or two during Christmas, where they hired us who were high school students. My sister was a clerk and worked at the clerk at the post office before she went on to finish school and became a wonderful, wonderful elementary school teacher. My brother was a mail carrier. So all of this was part of our family, but the groundwork is laid at the beginning with our parents. What was so impressive for me as a young child, what was so had such an impact on me, is the way they felt about the union and making the workplace a better place, not only for my family, but for workers around the country. In fact, my father went to the conventions of the National Alliance of Postal Employees every year until he was 80 years old, 17 years after he had retired from the post office. That's how much he believed in the union. Martin Luther King said the best anti-poverty program he'd ever known was a union. Organized labor. So they have the opportunity to be here with you today. We had Reverend Barber here. We've had other leaders here from labor here. Because they know it's a moment right now at this point in time where we stick together. We got to come together. We got to stick together. We got to support each other. We got to build with each other. The old stories were great stories of Filipinos coming to the post office, or Hispanics coming to the post office, and others. Those are old stories, the immigrants coming to the post. Those are old stories, but we have new stories that we have to create. Those new stories are what we have to do here in the 21st century, because so much has changed. The evisceration of power of labor unions, the attempt to compromise our one great victory, that collective bargaining, is on the line. All those are the things that we have to fight, still fight for. Those are time to lay down and rest on our laurels of generations ago. The time is now. What does it look like? Because the post office is a national treasure. The first thing the Continental Congress set up was the post office. They understood the importance of people communicating, a new country communicating. They set up their post office. They established that. So we have to treat it as a national treasure, because the post office was always about building a country too. And those of us who come to the post office in the last part of the 20th century and into the 21st century are going to talk about the same thing. How do we build a better country? How do we build a better workforce? How do we build better citizens? And that's what this argument's about. This is what this discussion. So here we have true democracy right here. Real organic democracy happening right here in the post office, and we're all here to participate in it. So we have a lot of work to do. When I talked to Mark, I said, I'm in. Provide me some marching orders so we can be part of this work. Because what I see now is a quote that students in Jackson, Mississippi, and Canton, Mississippi, working with Nissan workers down there, who simply want to have a vote so they can have a union, the choice to have a union. What they say, and we have to say it, that workers' rights are civil rights. That workers' rights are civil rights. That's what we're talking about there. So the campaign that's building against Staples, the campaign to use the post office for the many varied services it has the capacity to be used for, is important level, because it reestablishes, it reintegrates that into our lives, the post office and the lives, and says that we own it, that we the people own this post office. Not private, not the private sector,
Not big business, but we the people on the post office. And we're going to fight for that and stand up to that. And I know that we'll win. Thank you very much.
Microphone number 6, had a privilege. Mike, next, please.
Ed Thompson, 4th Area Local. I'd like to ask the chair if Danny Glover is an honorary member.
It will accept, we'll certainly accept the motion of that. Would you like to make a motion, brother?
So moved.
There's a motion on the floor and seconded to make Danny Glover an honorary member of the American Postal Workers Union. Let's vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, our union grows again. Brother Danny Glover is an honorary member of the American Postal Workers Union.
Being here with you is something that's important.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.